Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
To get confirmed as a Supreme Court Justice today, you have to give a masterpiece performance.
I will work hard, and I will do my best to consider every case impartially, modestly, with commitment to principle, and in accordance with law.
Yes, for a generation now, the game in Supreme Court confirmation hearings has been to say as little about your real views as you possibly can. Our current Chief Justice was a master.
Judges and justices are servants of the law, not the other way around. Judges are like umpires. Umpires don't make the rules, they apply them. The role of an umpire and a judge is critical. They make sure everybody plays by the rules, but it is a limited role. Nobody ever went to a ball game to see the umpire.
You'd think John Roberts believed in nothing much in particular at all. No hint that he believed the Constitution was written to give corporations the same rights as human beings, or that the Second Amendment had nothing to do with a well-regulated militia. So now it's Elena Kagan's turn, and the hearings are underway. And we are giving you a choice on WNYC today. You can listen to the full hearings streamed live and uninterrupted on our website, WNYC.org. But here on the air, we want to take a few minutes first to set up a possible framework for listening today. Harvard Law professor Noah Feldman is here to lay out what he thinks it would mean to be a real liberal Supreme Court justice in the 21st century. And then we will hear an exchange that just took place a few minutes ago between Republican Jeff Sessions and Elena Kagan on the question of liberalism. In a New York Times Magazine article this week, Noah Feldman wrote that none of the so-called liberals on the court today actually fill the bill of a contemporary liberal, including Sonia Sotomayor or today's nominee. Noah Feldman has a book coming out in the fall on FDR and the Supreme Court, and he joins us now. Hi, Noah. Thanks for doing this. Welcome back
to
WNYC.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
I think this was a very valuable article for defining constitutional liberalism or progressivism for our time, and you think that the current liberals on the court are more concerned about preserving liberal gains of the past than pushing for a contemporary progressive agenda. Talk about some of the justices and why you see them that way, Ginsburg or Breyer or whomever. Take your pick.
Justice Ginsburg was a real hero of the movement for equality, especially equality for women. And when she was a lawyer and a law professor before she became a judge, she made great advances in that area. But since she came on the Supreme Court, and it's important to notice that she and Justice Breyer are the only two Democratic nominees in 42 years, which is a shocking statistic if you just let that sink in for a second, 42 years and only two Democratic nominees. They were mostly involved in the business of defending the liberal gains of the 1960s and 70s against the pushback from conservative appointees of Reagan and both Presidents Bush. And so they essentially dug in their heels and did the best job they could to play defense, and that's really been the state of play. And so the question now is, are those fights of the past, the fights about liberty and equality, the fights that are coming next for the new Supreme Court justices? And as you know, there will be, with Justice Kagan, there will be, if she's confirmed, there will be four new justices just in 5 years.
So you mentioned Breyer and Ginsburg as the only two Democratic nominees in 42 years, but what about Sonia Sotomayor?
Well, she was she ended the dry spell, as it were, and it's early days for her yet. She's only been on the bench for a short time. In her confirmation hearings and in her earlier jurisprudence, she certainly joined the other liberals in defending the gains of the liberal court over the years, but she didn't express a new idea about where the Constitution ought to go or any forward-looking vision, especially on the big issues that the court is now facing this year and is going to face in the next 5 or 10 years, which are really issues about the economy and about the power of corporations relative to ordinary citizens, and about the big questions about what kinds of rights big corporations have relative to the ordinary individual.
So lay it out for us a little bit more, because I think this is really the heart of your article and your thinking on this, that a progressive judicial agenda for today needs to revolve around, I guess, the tensions between government power and corporate power, correct?
Exactly. And I use the word progressive for a very specific reason, not because I'm using this as a euphemism for liberal, but because the progressive movement, going back more than 100 years, was born with the recognition that corporations are an extraordinary technology. They're a technology designed to generate and concentrate wealth. And that's the only thing a corporation does. If you have a for-profit corporation, its reason for being is to make money. And they'll do what it takes to make money. And we've got plenty of proofs of that, including trying to dominate the legislative process and the government process. And if you have a system that allows this through campaign finance, through advertising, and through defending those corporations against government regulation that tries to limit their activities, then they will, and this is not intended as a slam on corporations, they will inevitably act to further their own interests, which is what they're designed to do. And the progressive movement has always recognized the role of government is not to shut down the corporation, because it's good to have for-profit corporations, but to regulate the corporation and make sure that it doesn't pollute the environment, that it doesn't give unfair working hours for ordinary people, and perhaps most important of all, that it doesn't dominate the democratic process to the point where we no longer actually have a functioning government.
But why is that a constitutional agenda, which is what the Supreme Court deals with, rather than a policy agenda, like how much to regulate the big banks or how much to leave health care to the free market, the things that the Obama administration has been dealing with at the policy level?
If the Supreme Court did what Chief Justice Roberts claimed in his confirmation hearings and sat on its hands and just was an umpire calling balls and strikes, then maybe you could rely on the administration and the Congress to pass regulation. But that's not how the Supreme Court actually operates today or how it's ever actually operated. In fact, the Supreme Court, depending on whether it can get 5 votes for a position, often blocks the government from doing what it wants. So, for example, in the big case that was discussed a lot this year, Citizens United, the one that President Obama scolded the Supreme Court about during his State of the Union address,
which held that corporations can spend unlimited amounts of money to influence elections.
Exactly, because they are just like individuals. The corporation has all the same constitutional rights that I have or that you have. They were striking down. 5 justices of the Supreme Court struck down a law passed by Congress and signed by actually the previous president, which specifically limited corporations in their election spending. So when the Supreme Court is being activist and saying that the Constitution protects corporations against regulation, that's what turns this into a fundamental constitutional issue. And the other side has to do more than simply repeat the John Roberts position, oh, well, all we do is call balls and strikes, because as we know, that's simply not true. As I think every American knows, that's simply not true. Instead, the progressive side of the court has to explain why it is that our Constitution permits the regulation of corporations. And the reason is very simple. The reason is that our Constitution values the democratic process and values the capacity of the ordinary individual to flourish in our society. The pursuit of happiness is the pursuit of happiness for individuals, not the pursuit of happiness for corporations. And so corporations just can't realistically, in the real world in which we live, be treated as though they were individuals without giving them a tremendous set of advantages.
So before we hear these clips of Elena Kagan from within the last hour being asked about her views on the Constitution and on liberalism, you wrote in your Times Magazine piece that Elena Kagan has done nothing so far to show you that she is a judicial progressive in the way you were just describing it. Do you have any clues, really, from her, you know, close to the vest record to really tell you one way or the other?
No. I think that Dean Kagan, she's my dean and I consider her a friend,
has been extraordinarily cautious
in not expressing any strong views on these topics at any stage of her career.
Dean Kagan, because she was the dean of the Harvard Law School.
She was dean of the Harvard Law School.
Currently teach.
And then Solicitor General of the United States, as she presently is. She's also General Kagan, because they call the Solicitor General General, which can sometimes be confusing. So I guess right now she's General Kagan. But in any case, Elena Kagan has been very careful over the course of her career. She's written 6 academic articles in the course of her career, which is relatively few for an academic. She has written memoranda to her boss, Justice Thurgood Marshall, when she worked for him, some of which she's walked back from in recent years, explaining that she was working for him and she was trying to channel his views, which is very fair. That's what you do when you're a law clerk. And then as a policy director in the Clinton White House, she took a range of positions, which, again, she's often said, well, I was trying to do what my boss wanted. Again, the fair defense, that's her job. And last, the Solicitor General, she's representing the governor of the United States. So all the jobs she's had, she's explained her positions by saying, well, I had a job, this was my role, and I followed my role. She's been pretty careful not to express in anything that she's written a big philosophy of the Constitution.
All right, so after a break, Noah Feldman will stay with us, and we will listen together to 2 stretches of the hearing so far this morning. These just took place within the last hour. We have a Democrat and a Republican both questioning Kagan about her views on the Constitution, and Republican Jeff Sessions of Alabama questioning her about her views on liberalism and the Constitution. And we will get Noah Feldman's reaction based on the idea of progressive constitutionalism that he's been laying out. So stay tuned. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and listeners, we invite you to take our final 10-question demographics quiz and see how well you know our area. Thousands of our listeners have been having fun with these quizzes this year and learning some things along the way with questions pulled from census data. See if you can answer all 10 questions about the demographics of the New York area in the final demographics quiz in this series. Question 1, which local county has the highest median income? Go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, and see how well you know Greater New York. Now, we continue with our coverage of the Elena Kagan confirmation hearings this morning. We've been talking to Noah Feldman, Harvard Law professor who wrote a Times Magazine article this week about what a progressive approach to the Constitution would look like in the 21st century and why he thinks no liberal on the court actually is that kind of progressive, including apparently the nominee of today, Dean Elena Kagan. The first questioner of the day was Patrick Leahy, Democrat of Vermont. His first question, as we begin to listen to some of these excerpts, and then we'll see what Noah Feldman thinks about them through his lens. Patrick Leahy's first question was about Kagan's mother and father, but his first question of substance was about her view of the Constitution as a living document. And yes, as Noah Feldman said earlier, we will hear the senators refer to her as General Kagan, because she's President Obama's Solicitor General. Here is 4 minutes of Patrick Leahy and General Elena Kagan.
The chairman of the Republican National Committee criticized you last month for agreeing with Justice Thurgood Marshall's observation that our Constitution, as originally drafted, was imperfect. The criticism surprised me because everything you read about the founders, they knew that they would lay down something that would not cover every foreseeable thing. I mean, how could they possibly foresee what the country is today? They wrote in broad terms. They couldn't foresee every challenge. So what's your response to this criticism of you that was made because you agreed with Justice Marshall? How would you describe the way the Constitution has been amended since it was originally drafted?
Well, Justice Leahy, the framers were incredibly wise men, and if we always remember that, we'll do pretty well, because part of their wisdom was that they wrote a constitution for the ages, and this was very much in their mind. This was part of their consciousness. You know, even that phrase that I quoted yesterday from the preamble of the Constitution, I said the Constitution was to secure blessings of liberty. I didn't quote the next part of that phrase, It said blessings of liberty for themselves and their posterity. So they were looking towards the future. They were looking generations and generations and generations ahead and knowing that they were writing a constitution for all that period of time and that life and that circumstances and that the world would change just as it had changed in their own lives very dramatically. So they knew all about change. And they wrote a constitution, I think, that has all kinds of provisions in it. So there are some that are very specific provisions. It just says what you're supposed to do and how things are supposed to work. So it says to be a senator, you have to be 30 years old. And that just means you have to be 30 years old. And it doesn't matter if people mature earlier. It doesn't matter if people's lifespans changed. You just have to be 30 years old because that's what they wrote and that's what they meant, and that's what we should do. But there are a range of other kinds of provisions in the Constitution of a much more general kind, and those provisions were meant to be interpreted over time, to be applied to new situations and new factual contexts. So the Fourth Amendment is a great example of this. It says, there shall be no unreasonable searches and seizures. Well, what's unreasonable? That's a question. The framers could have given like a whole primer on police practices, you know, which searches were reasonable and which searches weren't reasonable and lots of different rules for saying that, but they didn't do that. And I think that they didn't do that because of this incredible wisdom that they had, that they knew that the world was going to change and that, you know, they didn't live with bomb-sniffing dogs and with heat-detecting devices.
And computers.
And computers. And all these questions that judges, courts, everybody is struggling with, police in the Fourth Amendment context. And I think that they laid down, sometimes they laid down very specific rules. Sometimes they laid down broad principles. Either way, we apply what they say, what they meant to do. So in that sense, we are all originalists.
Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan with Democratic Senator, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Patrick Leahy of Vermont. Now, after a bit of back and forth and a new question from Leahy, Kagan returned to this question of the Constitution.
May I say a little bit more about what you started with about constitutional changes?
Sure.
Just to show my commitment to being open,
sure.
All right?
Go ahead.
But you said something which just sort of triggered a thought in me, and I just wanted to, as you said, there are all these many changes that have happened to the Constitution. And I think it's important to realize that those changes do come in sort of two varieties. One is the formal amendment process, and I think it was Senator Cornyn yesterday who talked about the formal amendment process, and that's tremendously important. So, you know, when Thurgood Marshall said that this was a defective constitution, you know, he was talking about the fact that this was a constitution that counted slaves as three-fifths of a human being, that didn't do anything about that original sin of our country. And the 14th Amendment changed that. The 14th Amendment was an enormous break after the Civil War and created a different constitution for America. So partly the changes come in that way.
Now, the first Republican to ask questions this morning was Jeff Sessions of Alabama. He picked up on that answer with his first question. Here is Sessions and Kagan, and this is about 8 minutes of their exchange on the role of the Constitution and whether or not she is a liberal. You heard reference to that exchange in the NPR newscast at the top of the hour. You'll hear that clip at the end of this exchange, but here it is in full. This may be a central 8 minutes of Elena Kagan's testimony. Elena Kagan's with Republican Jeff Sessions.
You indicated that there is an amendment process in the Constitution. There are two ways to do so in the Constitution. Is there any other way than those two ways that the Constitution approved to change the Constitution?
Well, Senator Sessions, the Constitution is an enduring document. The Constitution is the Constitution, and the Constitution does not change except by the amendment process. But as I suggested to Chairman Leahy, the Constitution does, over time, we're asked, courts are asked to think about how it applies to new sets of circumstances, to new problems, to things that the framers never dreamed of. And in applying the Constitution case by case by case to new circumstances, to changes in the world, the constitutional law that we live under does develop over time.
Well, developing is one thing, and in many of the provisions, as you noted, they're not specific, but they're pretty clear, I think, but not always specific. But you're not empowered to alter that document and change its meaning. You're empowered to apply its meaning faithfully in new circumstances. Wouldn't you agree?
I do agree with that, Senator Sessions. That's the point I was trying to make, that, however inartfully, that you take the Fourth Amendment and you say there's unreasonable searches and seizures, and that provision stays the same unless it's amended. That's the provision. And then the question is, what counts as an unreasonable search and seizure? And new cases come before the court, and the court tries to think about to the extent that one can glean any meaning from the text itself, from the original intent, from the precedents, from the history, from the principles embedded in the precedent, and the court sort of step by step by step, one case at a time, figures out how the Fourth Amendment applies.
Well, I do believe that there's some out there who think the court really has an opportunity to update the Constitution and make it say what they'd like it to say. I know we've seen a bit of a revival in the idea of the progressive legal movement, that people in the early 20th century advocated views for changing America. They felt the Constitution often blocked them from doing that, and they were very aggressive in seeking ways to subvert or get around that Constitution. Your former colleague at University of Chicago, Richard Epstein, said any constitutional doctrine that stood in the way of the comprehensive social or economic reforms, he's referring to the progressives, had to be rejected or circumvented. And he noted that the progressive influence continues to exert itself, he's talking about today, long past the New Deal, in modern Supreme Court decisions that address questions of federalism, economic liberties, and takings for public use. I believe that's a dangerous philosophy. I believe that's a philosophy not justified by any judge on the court. And I'm worried about the trends. I think the American people are. Greg Craig, the former chief counsel to President Obama, who known you for some time, I understand, said of you, she is largely a progressive in the mold of Obama himself, close quote. Do you agree with that?
Well, Senator Sessions, I'm not quite sure how I would characterize my politics, but one thing I do know is that my politics would be, must be, have to be completely separate from my judgment. And I agree with you to the extent that you're saying, look, judging is about considering a case that comes before you, the parties that comes before you, listening to the arguments they make, reading the briefs they file, and then considering how the law applies to their case. How the law applies to their case, not how your own personal views, not how your own political views might suggest, you know, anything about the case, but what the law says, whether it's the Constitution or whether it's a statute. Now, sometimes that's a hard question, what the law says, and sometimes judges can disagree about that question, but the question is always what the law says, and if it's a constitutional question, it's what the text of the Constitution says. It's what the history says, the structure, the precedent, but what the law says, not
well,
what a judge's personal views.
I agree, but the point I was just wanting to raise with you is that this idea, this concept of legal progressivism is afoot. I noticed E.J. Dionne in yesterday's Washington Post had an article, started off, second paragraph is saying, Democratic senators are planning to put the right of citizens to challenge corporate power at the center of their critique of an activist conservative judging, offering a case that has not been fully aired since the great progressive era of Justice Louis Brandeis. And I think we do have this national discussion going on about a revival of progressivism. Let me ask you about this. Vice President Biden's Chief of Staff, Ron Klain, who served on Chief Counsel of this committee, a skilled lawyer, was Vice President Chief of Staff to Vice President Gore also, I believe, who's known you for a number of years, said this about you. Elena Kagan is clearly a legal progressive. I think Elena is someone who comes from the progressive side of the spectrum. She clerked for Judge Mikva, clerked for Justice Marshall, worked in the Clinton administration, in the Obama administration. I don't think there's any mystery to the fact that she is. As I said, more progressive role than not, close quote. Do you agree with that?
Senator Sessions, it's absolutely the case that I have served in two Democratic administrations, and I think...
No, but I'm asking, do you agree with the characterization that you are a legal progressive?
Senator Sessions, I honestly don't know what that label means. I've worked in two Democratic administrations. Senator Graham suggested yesterday, and I think he's right, that you can tell something about me and my political views from that. But as I suggested to you, that my political views are one thing.
Well, but I agree with you exactly that you should not be condemned for being a political believer and taking part in the process and having views. But I'm asking about his firm statement that you are a legal progressive, which means something. I think he knew what he was talking about. He's a skilled lawyer. He's been in the midst of the great debates of this country about law and politics, just as you have. And so I ask you again, do you think that is a fair characterization of your views? Certainly you don't think he was attempting to embarrass you or hurt you in that process, do you?
I love my good friend Ron Klain, but I guess I think that people should be allowed to label themselves.
All right, so an 8-minute excerpt of Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan with Republican Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama from about an hour ago in her confirmation hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee. And still with us is Harvard Law professor Noah Feldman, who wrote an article in the New York Times Magazine this week saying that what is needed, in his opinion, is a new legal progressivism, but that he doesn't see that in any of the so-called liberal justices on the court now or in the nominee, Elena Kagan. So through that lens, Noah Feldman, it must have been very interesting for you to hear that exchange where Senator Sessions was really pushing Elena Kagan on this idea of being a legal progressive.
And she, as you heard, was absolutely unwilling to take up that description. And I understand that. I mean, she's, first of all, herself, in many ways, a centrist, I think. It may simply be an unfair categorization of her. And as I said in the piece, and to you just a moment ago, there's nothing in her written record that would say that that is a fair label to apply to her. And so perhaps it's just not the right label. It's also true, of course, that she wants to be confirmed. And the last thing she wants is a headline that says, you know, Kagan describes self as legal progressive. She said she would like to label herself, which means she would like not to be labeled at all, at least until she's confirmed.
And listeners, we can take your reactions for a few minutes to the stretches of the hearings that we've listened to so far. Elena Kagan with Pat Leahy, Elena Kagan with Jeff Sessions there. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. If you have any quick reactions to these clips, and we'll play some more coming up a little later in the program. But through that lens that you were laying out before, where you think the essential issue today is government power versus corporate power and just how much a corporation is given the rights of individuals, of human beings, and how much corporations have power over our lives, he seemed to even go there, but she didn't bite at all.
she didn't. And again, this is partly the cat and mouse game of a confirmation hearing. If they get to the point of discussing the Citizens United case, which is a case that Elena Kagan argued on behalf of the United States, then I think these issues will come to the fore to a greater degree. And again, I would expect that she is somewhere in the middle on this question, that she probably does think that there are some constitutional rights that ought to be extended to corporations, but perhaps not the full panoply of constitutional rights that the court is increasingly giving them. I suspect that she will try to avoid committing herself to a position on these issues by saying that these are the issues that are going to be before the court in the near future, which of course is true. They are going to be in front of the court. Which brings us around to an article that she and Senator Sessions and Senator Leahy discussed, which she wrote in 1995, saying that confirmation hearings should be more substantive than they are. And they immediately asked her about it, of course. And she said, oh, it's been a whole half hour, and you finally asked me about it. She's going to avoid many of the fundamental right. substantive issues while focusing on legal philosophy instead.
And just looking at our comments page and our Facebook page, there's a lot of backlash to the whole process. Cole from Manhattan writes, which ridiculous pretense should we believe? That a flaming liberal will get on the court and institute their beliefs? Or that it hardly matters who a president chooses because a judge is an indifferent referee? And Jackie on Facebook writes, too boring and insignificant, completely scripted. Unlike the Wimbledon matches this morning, my full attention is there because the outcome, as we see with Venus's ouster, is not predictable. So
well,
you know.
I wouldn't want to stand on that Wimbledon comparison. Wimbledon can be very exciting, and I think things have more of a script to them. I think the person who's writing it is onto something there. I mean, Elena Kagan did actually offer an account of how the Constitution evolves through interpreting the general passages, but it was sufficiently vague that she and Senator Sessions could agree on it. So that does suggest to you that if she and Sessions agree, it's not much of a theory.
I guess so, because Billy on our Facebook page also wrote, watching on CNN from the juror lounge, am struck by Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III's disgraceful tirade and disheartened by Kagan's response, swearing fealty and reverence to the military. Eesh, what a lot of phonies.
Well, that I think one has to be a little more careful there. It is absolutely the case from Elena Kagan's record as dean at Harvard Law School that she paid a great deal of attention to veterans who came to the law school. I presided at a ceremony for commissioning with General David Petraeus, the other kind of general, and Elena Kagan, when she was already Solicitor General, who came back to Harvard specifically and attended that session. She was very, very good to the students on campus who are returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. And I think she actually does take that extremely seriously. In her office at Harvard Law School, she had really very little decoration, but she did have a ceremonial West Point hat that she had been given when she went to give a lecture at West Point. So I think it's actually very sincere. I have a lot of personal evidence to suggest that's very sincere. On the other hand, she also clearly abhorred, as she said, the policy of don't ask, don't tell. The question is, are those two things consistent? And in my view, they are consistent.
Let's take a phone call. Richard in Maspeth. Richard, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. First-time caller here. I like the show. I just believe that my comment is that she's really a very hard liberal, and she really has no background in any law or anything like that, other than she just graduated as a very prominent lawyer. And my second point is on the gentleman you have as a guest. What's the difference between corporations and groups that are incorporated having a right to speech, like Greenpeace or BP?
That's a great question. And Noah, you're right about that in your Times Magazine article. And I guess you think that there should be a difference under the law between a corporation, a for-profit corporation, and the non-for-profits that you cited. So, for example, the NRA or the NAACP were, I think, your examples, or the ones that Richard just gave.
I agree with that absolutely. I think Richard is absolutely right to ask that question. If you get a group of people together to amplify their voice in the political sphere, like the NRA or the NAACP, then I think it's completely appropriate for them to have the free speech rights, for the most part at least, that ordinary individuals have. When, however, and the call used BP as an example, so let's use that as a great example, you get a group of capital together, body of capital together, money together to form a corporation with the goal of making more money for the shareholders, which, as I say, I'm all for. I mean, I like corporations. I think they're the best technology for accruing wealth that we've ever had in history. It shouldn't be permitted to speak freely in influencing elections in the same way that the NRA should be permitted to act. And the Supreme Court, unfortunately, in the Citizens United case, broke that distinction down altogether and said that BP was exactly the same as the NRA. And I think we all understand, just as a matter of practical reality, that's just not so. They're fundamentally differently placed. The NRA exists to advance a certain social and political worldview, and BP exists in order to accrue profits for its shareholders. And because those have different functions in the world, they should be treated differently by the law and by the Constitution.
You know, we are actually getting some Supreme Court news this morning, believe it or not, even though they officially finished their session yesterday, handed down their last decision yesterday. These two things have just crossed the wire, Noah, and they are right in the area that you're talking about with respect to corporate power. And it's just regarding which cases they have agreed or not agreed to hear for the next session. But even so, this tells us something. First of all, the Supreme Court is staying out of a dispute between Nigerian families and Pfizer over the drug maker's use of a new antibiotic on children during a deadly outbreak of meningitis in the mid-1980s. So the court won't even hear that challenge to Pfizer. But the court says it will decide whether a company can legally retaliate against an employee's friends, relatives, or spouse for the employee's filing of a discrimination claim. And I don't know if you're familiar with that case. I'm not, but it's hard for me to believe this question is even being asked, that a company could legally retaliate against an employee's friends, relatives, or spouse for the employee's filing of a discrimination claim. Do you know the case?
I don't know the case, but I can, to some extent, reconstruct what the issue probably is, with the caveat that I might be wrong. It's probably an interpretation not of the Constitution, but of a statute, the anti-discrimination law, which is pretty clear in saying that if you filed any sort of an anti-discrimination claim, that the company can't retaliate against you. And the question must be, reading the law very literally, the corporation will be arguing that that doesn't cover firings of other people, not you. And the plaintiff will be arguing that, reading the logical sense of the law, it must be the case that if they can't retaliate against you, they certainly can't retaliate against your friends or relatives. And that is, in fact, the kind of case that the Supreme Court, believe it or not, faces all the time, that, again, very squarely lines up the relationship between the employer and the employee, and probably between a corporation and an individual. And that is, in some ways, not the only really important issue. There are issues of basic liberty, there are issues of criminal justice, there's issues of racial justice, but that is among the most fundamental kinds of questions that the Supreme Court decides. And I think going forward, in our period where the economy is so central and corporate power is so obvious in the wake of the TARP and in the wake of, that is to say, the big government bailout of corporations and in the wake of the BP spill, these are going to be the central issues for the next few years.
So before you go, if you think Kagan is not this kind of person, or at least won't reveal herself in the hearings to be the kind of judicial progressive that you'd like to see on the court with respect to corporate power, who would you have rather seen nominated? Maybe somebody like Elizabeth Warren, whose name was, you know, promoted by a lot of progressives on the basis of her strong stand against corporate power in her overseeing of the TARP program? Or is there
someone
you would like to see?
Let me put it this way. Both Elena Kagan and Liz Warren are friends and colleagues of mine, and I respect them both enormously. What's striking to me is that we've got a confirmation process now, which is so tight, so detailed, that somebody like Liz Warren would be extremely difficult to get confirmed because she's publicly stated her views on so many important and controversial issues again and again and again, and really mixed it up in the real world of politics. But you know, 60 years ago or 70 years ago, when Franklin Roosevelt was doing his Supreme Court nominations, he nominated William O. Douglas to the Supreme Court, who was chairman of the SEC and was sort of a Liz Warren before the time. You know, he was in the face of corporate power and saying so very explicitly and making speeches that got the corporations angry. I'd like to live in a world where that's an option. I'd like to live in a world where we could seriously, where the president could seriously have said to himself, I've got these wonderful candidates. I have Elizabeth Warren. I have Elena Kagan. They're both excellent. Which one should I choose on the merits? Not which one can I get past the Senate, given the views that she has expressed publicly. And right. I think that would be really a world in which we had a much better chance of getting strong beliefs on the Supreme Court and great Supreme Court justices.
Noah Feldman, Harvard Law professor. He's got a book coming out in the fall about FDR and the Supreme Court, and he has that New York Times Magazine piece this week about legal progressives and why there are none on the court today. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We'll have more from the Kagan hearings later in the program, but first we'll take a brief detour into the life of a New York author who has moved 39 times. Stay with us.